I hate unemployment and I tell you why. I want to keep working till the day I die. I like to work, I do it well. And when I can't feed my family, Lord, I feel like hell. Lord, give me a job of work to do. Lord, give me a job of work to do. That's all I want, that's all I ask of you. The man from the government says it's fine to walk on over to the free food line. Nice of the government to be so fair, but I don't want my friends to see me there. Lord, give me a job of work to do. Lord, give me a job of work to do. That's all I want, that's all I ask of you.
Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday. It is the 21st of May and 13 minutes past 9 o'clock. A delight to have you all with us. We have a great panel and very happy to introduce them all to you. A reminder, you can certainly join in on the discussion. We love when you do so. All you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org. If you're using any other address, don't. We won't get it. So it's panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we would love for you to weigh in on the topics that we're going to discuss this morning. Big stuff to talk about, so we'll get right to it. Alan Chartok, good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Joe, and thank you, and thanks to Big Mike for playing the great Tom Paxton. Central to the United States right now and to the world is, you know, people going back to work and doing it under safe conditions. And hopefully that we won't reignite this whole thing. But, you know, I love Tom Paxton. And I heard it this morning while I was walking, and I said, we got to play that for everybody.
Excellent. Well, we'll be hearing Tom Paxton throughout the morning this morning. So
great.
Good stuff. Thank you very much. Let's go to Philip Glotzbach, Skidmore College president, and very nice to have you with us, sir. Hello. Oh, I have to press buttons. Oh, dear. Hello, Philip. How are you?
Yeah, I'm here. Oh, the button.
I didn't press the button. I'm sorry.
Got to press that button. Good morning. Thank you. Thank you, Joe and Alan, for inviting me back. I appreciate it.
Now, how much longer do you have as president?
Officially, I'm finished as of June 30th.
Okay.
You will be retiring at that date.
Unofficially?
We're still, I think, up until then as well. There's an awful lot going on. There's no glide path here with all the things that are working. We're working hard to have a good transition with my successor, Mark Connor, who's the provost at Washington and Lee. And because we're making so many decisions, we may want to talk about this later, but that will affect his presidency, of course. I mean, we'll just go over into the fall. We're involving him in these conversations as well. So I think it's a good transition. But I will be working up till the end of June.
Terrific. Well, we're glad that you're with us, and I thank you very much for that. Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick. Judy, good morning. How are you?
I am fine, Joe. Glad to be with you.
Wonderful to have you with us. You've already been through the media project. How was that? Everything good?
Through. It's true. It was like a meat grinder today.
Well,
what did I do this time?
Doesn't have to be you.
Man.
I mean, I guess it was, but yeah, it doesn't have to be.
he had a lot to say about NPR. Everybody got notice. Yeah.
Okay. And Vera Akarios-Kelly joins us, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I also struggled with technology this morning. This is our world now, isn't it?
It is. Yes, it is. And but we thank you for dealing with it, and here we are. That's the good news is we're all here. So there you go. All right, let's get to stuff. Let's talk about what's going on. And we go to ultimately the state of Michigan. The president is stepping up attacks on the mail vote, making false claims about fraud. He initially said he might withhold federal funding from Michigan and Nevada if the states move forward in expanding vote by mail, though he later backed off that threat. On Wednesday, he escalated the assault on mail voting, M-A-I-L, falsely claiming that Michigan and Nevada were engaged in voter fraud and had acted illegally and threatening to withhold federal funds. The president inaccurately accused Michigan of sending mail ballots to its residents, as his aides later acknowledged, and he offered no basis for his claims of illegal actions by either Michigan or Nevada. The Michigan Secretary of State has sent ballot applications, not the ballots themselves, to registered voters, a growing practice among election officials, including in states led by Republicans. In Nevada, where the Republican Secretary of State declared the primary a near all-mail election, ballots are being sent to registered voters. As most states largely abandoned in-person voting because of health concerns over the coronavirus, Mr. Trump and many of his Republican allies have launched a series of false attacks to demonize mail voting as fraught with fraud and delivering an inherent advantage to Democratic candidates, despite there being scant evidence for either claim. By day's end, Mr. Trump had corrected his tweet about Michigan, saying officials there had mailed applications, not ballots, though he continued to assert the Secretary of State had acted illegally. He also backed off his threat to hold back funding, saying Michigan would find out very soon if it's necessary, quote unquote, according to pool report from the White House. I don't think it's going to be necessary. Mr. Trump has often made threats about cutting off funding to states, but has not always followed through. Aides compared his Wednesday morning tweets to previous attempts to withhold federal funds to sanctuary cities. That from this morning's New York Times. Alan, let's begin with you.
Okay, well, thank you, Joe. You know, the whole concept of the American taxpayer money, our money, being his money, Trump's money, to punish his political enemies with is so repugnant that one can hardly keep their head together. The other thing is that, you know, Republicans have always, New York State, while the Republicans had the state Senate, as soon as there was any kind of bill that would increase the franchise, how many people voted, they were against it. Why? I think political scientists have known for a long time, I'd like to hear Vera on this, that the people who are most well-heeled are most likely to vote in larger numbers, and the people who are flipping hamburgers and other people are not. And, you know, if you make it easier to vote, they will, and that'll hurt the Republicans. So that's what I got to say about that.
Vera, you're up.
Yeah, so I think this entire narrative is just to redirect, whip up anger in certain states. But in fact, you know, as Alan said, there's absolutely no evidence for standard sort of practices of voter fraud through mail in ballots. Mm-hmm. And it affects, interestingly enough, just as many Republican voters and Democratic voters when the president sort of, you know, spews these incorrect stories. What we find is that older people and more well-established middle class plus voters tend to show up at the voting booth. And if you don't have as much economic flexibility to take time off to vote, or you simply feel like your voice is not represented, you tend not to participate in elections. So Alan is right on that. And this entire effort that Trump is engaged in is to redirect from other problematic issues and create a sort of the sense of fear in the country, which he always relies on as his ultimate way to manipulate the general public and create mayhem and swirls of discontent that he hopes to rely on during this election period in November.
Philip.
I don't have anything to add to that. I worry about all the charges of voter fraud, which, as we've said and you said and people have written time and time again, are unfounded. And as we know, in the public domain, it's so easy for an idea to get traction if it's simply repeated often enough. So this is a classical case of the voting public needs to understand what are the facts here.
Judy Patrick.
Hey, so what it does is it's sowing distrust of the electoral process, and that's very destructive for our democracy. And let's not forget, we're headed into a presidential election, and every time he puts the notion in people's heads that, you know, there's voter fraud, that you can't trust, you know, that you're going to have people who are not citizens voting, it all, bit by bit, chips away at Americans' trust in going to the poll and electing someone and making sure that the right person, you know, that the person who gets the most votes actually takes office. And so I foresee this just intensifying in the months ahead as we head into this presidential election.
When you think about it, and you look at by the way, the president is going to Michigan to get today. He is going to be heading to a Ford plant. And so it'll be interesting to see how that goes. The big brouhaha there seems to be that the attorney general asked him to wear a mask, or the secretary of state, I guess, asked him to wear a mask, and we're not sure he's going to. So that ought to be interesting, too. But Alan, I mean, given what is going on with the overall, I want to bring the Postal Service into it, too, of when we say vote by mail. And obviously a lot of people are pushing this, not just the Democrats, but do we know what the Postal Service is going to look like in the fall?
No. Look, there are those people thinking that he's purposely trying to kill the Postal Service because of this vote-by-mail thing. I doubt it could be done, and I doubt it could be done in that kind of time, what with lawsuits and everything. However, I do want to go back to Judy for 1 minute and say that in addition to trying to fool with our electoral process, the guy is still trying to kill the media one way or another. So now you have newspapers, one of the most important thing, and electronic media being attacked by Trump, as well as the other trusted institutions that we're handling now.
Judy, when you think about those trusted institutions, but obviously the mail being one of them, it seems like an odd enemy, doesn't it?
Especially for his base, the mail, the Postal Service seems like a very strange thing for him to attack because he has a large rural base, and they rely on the mail more so than maybe urban dwellers. But the attacks on the media, you know, I've gotten to the point where I'm thinking, yeah, we can withstand this. I mean, we've taken 3 years of it. It's knocked us down. We've taken this huge, you know, jab to our credibility time and time again. But I think, if anything, it's strengthened journalism's resolve to fight back. And you're seeing efforts at every level of journalists trying to restore, to build the reader's trust in what they do and to show by just producing the facts that this will work. You see this a little bit in Governor Cuomo's presentations every morning, that mm-hmm. It's very popular, and he's just giving the facts. I mean, sometimes he veers off into a little bit of politicizing information, and he offers his opinion. But people are spellbound by the facts that he's giving, and I think that will, at the end of the day, be the salvation for the media, I'm hoping, praying.
A lot will depend on what happens in November. You know, I mean, a lot of this will be get undone if the Democrat wins. But if not, it could get much, much worse.
I want to go to Vera again, but this all comes as the White House and the Trump campaign are confronting polls that the president is trailing Joe Biden nationally in key swing states, including, get ready, Michigan. And by a lot, I should note.
11 points nationally. That's huge. Mm-hmm. That's
yeah.
big.
Vera.
Yeah, I mean, it is quite an eye-opening result from these most recent surveys. And I think President Trump continues to live in a bubble where he just decides what to believe, sort of similar or parallel to his interest in taking hydrochloroquine, when we know it doesn't help with preventing coronavirus infections, and it can have very negative effects for people with certain in certain age groups and physical conditions. So what he's doing is he just simply believes that he personally is the only man who can fly into Michigan and turn things around. And he sort of forgets that he has negatively spoken about factories not turning things around fast enough. And he has given orders, and instead of making cars, they didn't produce ventilators fast enough. And he has viciously gone after the working class for not helping with the coronavirus as one of the people he attacked. And a lot of Michiganders came, first responders came to New York to help with the crisis. And he sort of doesn't understand that a lot of people in Michigan deeply care about community, about building together. They have a lot of pride in supporting the nation. And his sort of sudden appearance there and speaking on issues he doesn't really understand as well as he should as a president, and pretending that he's a friend of the working class, it simply will not work. But for Trump, this is what he should do. He should be interacting and doing a little bit of performance in Michigan, and then he believes he can turn things around and put down the governor.
Well, how in the world are you going to convince him of that? He got to be president of the United States with this exact playbook. He's not going to change it, Vera. You and I both know it. You say he should. Yeah, he should be a better president. Yeah, he should be a more decent human being. But he got to be president this way. And we have all, as political scientists, known that one's first political success or their major political success becomes the playbook that they're always going to stay with. So what in the world would make us think that this guy has it in him to change?
Except you're right, Ellen. He believes that his advisors, his inner circle, is beginning to get nervous about the strategy because they're thinking, this is the old playbook. We have to come up with a few new and more innovative strategies. And I think they're quite nervous about Trump's conduct these days.
And they should be nervous. 11 points is a lot, a lot. It used to be 6 points. Now it's 11 points. Imagine when it's 15 points or 20 points. This guy is capable of going off the rails, and we know it. And he will always, because of his ability to change the conversation, always come up with hydrochloroquine or any of those other things that will take people's minds off the fact that he's firing the inspector generals and doing all these other things which he doesn't want on the table.
Meanwhile, not for nothing, while all of this was going on in Michigan and the president's Twitter feed, 10,000 residents of the state were forced to evacuate after two dam failures threatened to flood parts of Midland County in the state. So that, unfortunately, has not been mentioned in the president's tweeting. We will take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have much more to discuss, and we have our wonderful panelists to do it with. Alan Chartok, Philip Glotzbach, Judy Patrick, and Vera Akarios-Kelly. We welcome your letters, panel, at wamc.org. Just write them, keep them short, to the point, ready to go. Panel at wamc.org. We will be right back after this.
He was a man and a friend always. He stuck with me in the hard old days. He never cared if I had no dough. We rambled round in the rain and snow. And here's to you, my rambling boy. May all your rambling bring you joy. Here's to you, my rambling boy. May all your rambling bring you joy.
Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Quick correction. I mentioned right before the break that the president had not tweeted regarding what was going on in Michigan. I was looking at the president's Twitter feed, and no surprise, there are a lot of them, and I missed the one from 23 hours ago where he did write, "My team is closely monitoring the flooding in central Michigan. Stay safe and listen to local officials. Our brave first responders are once again stepping up to serve their fellow citizens. Thank you." So I just wanted to correct that. But again, the president in Michigan today. We will. We also have another breaking news story, which I'm interested in, which is we all followed this college admissions scandal, and there were some Hollywood names included, many non-Hollywood names, but the Hollywood names obviously were the ones that were brought in and had the most spotlight on them, Felicity Huffman being one. Well, Lori Loughlin and her husband have agreed to plead guilty to conspiracy charges in connection with securing the fraudulent admission of their two children to the University of Southern California as purported athletic recruits. You'll remember they said that they were in the rowing team, right? And then they didn't know that was all fake, I guess. So we're told that they are expected. It will include 2 months in prison. So that is just breaking at about 10 minutes ago. Philip, what do you make of this college admission scandal?
Why did I suspect you would turn to me on this?
I thought you were going to say, why did I come on to this?
Right, exactly. No, it's absolutely horrible. And it's just one more. Whenever something like this happens, or earlier in the broadcast, we were talking about trust. And whenever something like this happens, whenever there's a scandal in scientific research where it turns out that someone fabricated results, or a scandal, financial scandal somewhere, it erodes public trust in a particular institution. And our institutions in general are under attack these days. And sometimes, they deserve criticism. The idea that people who had the resources could spend this kind of money and bribe their way in for their children is just outrageous. And in some cases, I do know that the children were unaware of it. Some parents manipulated SAT scores, and the kid wasn't aware of it. So it hurts everybody. I'm, of course, terribly sorry that it happened. It's very surprising that the folks on the admissions side and the athletic side allowed this to happen. And all I can say is that all the admissions people I've known over the years have had an enormous amount of integrity. This is a case. There were enough instances here that, this was significant, so I don't want to brush it aside. But it is not something that at all is characteristic of how admissions works in general in colleges and universities.
But as this becomes obviously has been for ever since this story broke, has been part of the national conversation about admissions in college. So does it have you, given, as you say, the integrity of the people that you work with, but does it give you an opportunity to all have a conversation as to your own policies and practices?
Well, sure. Anytime something like this happens, you back off and take a look and say, all right, is it something? I mean, look, these were very high profile schools with high profile athletic programs, Division I. This is not something that's likely to happen in Division III schools like Skidmore or some of the other schools around. But sure, you stop and take a look and say, all right, what are our checks and balances here? And we actually did that. And we looked at how we dealt with athletic recruiting and how the communications between athletics and admissions go on and all that. And we didn't have to make any changes. But I'm sure that every school did. And I suspect that the schools in Division I, I would hope, took a particular look at this, in part because the size of the school and the number of recruits of students every year just creates more space for something to slip through. You know, when you're dealing with smaller numbers, it's easier to keep an eye on it. So I can't speak for those big schools. I assume they did. So, yeah, sure. It's always an opportunity to take a look and make sure.
But as you know, the governor of New York had a couple of real bad actors around him, either in jail or on the way to jail now. The governor didn't know. At least he says he didn't know. And the U.S. attorney, Pete Bharara, said he knows. He didn't think he knew. So therefore, you know, it could happen to anyone that somebody who gets corrupted, you know, around you. Phil, you're very lucky. You know, I'm married to a skitty. I know the reputation for integrity of the school. Nevertheless, it could happen to anybody, couldn't it?
Yes, absolutely. You know, can happen. So you have to have checks. You have to have systems and procedures so that that they do not create the space for you know, this kind of activity. That's true. I mean, that's just prudent for any business, any operation, any, you know, financial controls and so on.
Vera?
Yeah, in addition to the systems, of course, Philip is absolutely right. You have to have a very clear mission as an institution and focus on what the beliefs you really represent in the community. So, but at the same time, I think it's also very interesting to note a couple of things. The participants, as in terms of the parents or in some cases their children in these scams, come from profoundly entitled families, and they have an attitude because they're wealthy or because they're rich, they deserve something more and they don't have to work for it. And that is something that has been, in essence, an attitude that has also been empowered in this current administration more so than before. And I think that is an attitude that you will see a lot of people in the Midwest also reject. And I think that is something that we're beginning to see, because Trump promised to clean up the swamp or drain the swamp. Instead, he's creating new swamps or added swamps. And that general attitude is something a lot of voters reject. In addition to that, we also need to note that now educational institutions in many places are suffering economically. And we now have to pay particularly close attention to systems in place, because now we have this swirl of elite thinking and privilege that some people feel they deserve more than others just simply because of their position in society or their wealth. And secondly, educational institutions that are economically vulnerable. Now, that might provide new opportunities to come up with access to certain individuals. That's why systems are more important than ever. And also, I wanted to point out, it wasn't premier athletic programs at those institutions, Division I institutions, that were vulnerable, but it was sort of marginal sports. Small programs where athletes had been set, that top athletes were performing, and they were simply adding somebody who was not very important. I think rowing was one of sports. So it's not the premier sports programs at institutions, but it was sort of more marginal programs that were used for access.
Judy, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, you know, on behalf of all the families out there who struggle to get their kids into good colleges, I just think this is a classic example of entitlement. And the fact that Lori Loughlin is going to get 2 months in jail, 2 months, and she was facing up to 20 years. Her husband apparently is going to spend 5 months in jail. It seems like a travesty of justice. If they were serious about this, they would have given her a much more significant jail sentence. Maybe their case wasn't so strong. But if you recall, they have been declaring their innocence for the last 16 months. This was a pervasive scandal. It involved more than athletics. It involved people paying people to take the SAT exams for them. And it showed a pervasive problem in the college admission process that I'm not sure is completely resolved yet. I mean, these people got caught, but giving her 2 months in jail it seems like a slap on the wrist.
It really does, considering, as you said, it could have been up to 20 years. But also, you said, you know, how strong was their case? But they had them on tape, for goodness sakes. I mean, it wasn't like it was.
Oh, they did. You're right.
You know, they had a lot. for whatever that's worth. Phil, were you gonna, go ahead.
Not only that, Joe, but the people that they did it through are singing like canaries themselves.
Right. Yes. Yeah, the co-conspirators. Phil, were you going to say something? Yeah. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, as you look at it from the outside, and I've not been following this very closely in the last couple of months. There's just been other things on my mind. But it seemed as though it was a strong case, and one could make that argument. It's true that any system is open to certain kinds of abuse. There's always been cheating on exams as long as there have been students, and there are ways to cheat on the SATs, and they try to do it. So more and more schools are making SATs optional. We've done that, and a lot of schools have, and that's not really the reason, but SATs just turn out not to be very predictive in terms of college success. I'm not saying they don't tell you anything, and schools certainly can look at them, and if it's optional and students submit them, schools look at them. But I hate seeing this kind of stuff for the reasons I said before. So
and yet, Philip,
you have to keep an eye on it.
Right.
And yet, Philip, your point is extremely well taken, because every one of these institutions, including the SATs, think of all the kids who take extra classes so that they can do better on the SATs. Once again, going to the people who are most healed.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons that schools have backed off on making them a primary. Again, some schools still do, and sometimes it's just the sheer volume of applications that perhaps forces a school to do that. But Lori Guineer, the Harvard Law School professor, has said that the SAT is most predictive of the kind of car in the parents' driveway. And it is true that, some truth, because you can send your kid to a high-priced SAT prep program, and you can, the student can come up with an extra 100 or 200 points on the SAT. That's true. You can learn how to take that test better. So it's ironic, because the SAT was originally introduced as a way of leveling the playing field. The thought was it was going to measure aptitude, scholastic aptitude, back in, I think it was the 20s. It would give the kids who didn't have the privileged background a level playing field. Then over time, it became clear that, the background does matter, and you do better on the test if you have a better background. It's an interesting question to ask what SAT stands for these days. The Scholastic, the College Board that runs it changed the original moniker from Scholastic Aptitude Test to Scholastic Achievement Test for a while. But if you ask them today what SAT stands for, the answer is it doesn't stand for anything. It's just a set of initials, the name of the test, because what it measures has become a very complicated question.
Wow, like Truman's middle initial. Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have a lot of letters, so we'll get to those, and we'll continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Philip Glotzbach, Judy Patrick, and Vera Karius Kelly. We will return right after this.
It's a lesson too late for the learning, made of sand, made of sand. In the wink of an eye, my soul is turning. In your hand, in your hand. Are you going away with no word of farewell? Will there be not a trace left behind? Well, I could have loved you better, didn't mean to be unkind. You know that was the last thing on my mind. You've got reasons aplenty for going. This I know, this I know. For the weeds have been steadily growing. Please don't go, please don't go. Are you going out?
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. 49 minutes past 9 o'clock, and we welcome you, panel, at WAMC.org. We have a lot of letters, so let's get to them.
But before we do, Joe, I just want to say thank you again for Tom Paxton. I love that guy. His stuff is just unbelievable.
Good stuff. And playing it this morning, if you want to see the entire playlist, just go to WAMC.org/roundtable. WAMC.org/roundtable. Okay, we go to Bob, who says, after the panel finishes condemning the parents who bribed an athletic advisor, can we take a moment to keep in mind that virtually the same thing happens all the time in the form of legacy admissions for the children of parents rich enough to make big donations to colleges and universities? To me, that's the much bigger scandal. Philip,
well,
can
I just say to that it depends what kind of an institution you're talking about, because I think a lot of the sort of, you know, I think that might be the case when you look at Harvard or, you know, some elite university systems. But really, there are a lot of really strong liberal arts colleges where, you know, a parent's donation, the assumption is always, you know, legacy gets you in and you have all these wealthy people. At Siena College, we have vast numbers of middle class families. And yes, a lot of them had maybe a parent attend Siena or another regional college. But in fact, most of our students come from middle class backgrounds or lower middle class backgrounds. We have a lot of first generation students, and we do not have a ton of wealthy people who pay large donations to us to get their kids in. I think that is something that is so generalized. I sort of wanted to make the point that for some institutions that might be the case, for others it is not. It's really important to look at the type of institution.
Philip.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And certainly, I mean, for Skidmore, on average, it's about 10% of our student population has some relative with a connection, maybe a parent who went to the college or something. And there's an argument that says that a college is a kind of extended family, and if you have an alumni population, that having an alumnus or an alumna send a child to the college is a value, and you know, give them an extra look. But it goes back to the question of integrity. I mean, I would agree with Vera. I can't think of an occasion in my 17 years at Skidmore where somebody came to us and said, you know, I'll give you this, you know, this gift
library
if you admit this kid. I mean, sure, you know, it is important for colleges, particularly private schools, but increasingly for public institutions as well, to have a donor base and to have those donations. And those donations make possible, among other things, scholarships. And, you know, I would say what Vera says, we mm-hmm. have about half of our students on scholarships. We have turned down students, and we do it routinely, who are legacy applicants because they have not met the criteria that we have for admissions. And we do not want to admit a student who we're not convinced is going to succeed. We have turned down students from families who were on the board of trustees. If we don't, it doesn't happen that often, but you don't get that many applications. So you have to have integrity in the application process to say that we're selecting our students on the basis of these criteria. And there are some judgment calls, and sometimes you make them, but
and I so agree with what Phil just said, because as a faculty member, we are also very interested in having students in our classes who are willing to participate, engage, learn. And if you're not prepared and if you would be able to buy your way into the classroom, in essence, what does it say about the faculty evaluating students? I mean, this is something that we don't have happen at institutions like Siena.
Can I just say that America really needs to get over its infatuation with Ivy League schools or named colleges? I hired a lot of people when I was an editor, and I can tell you that some of the best people, most capable, most proficient people came from state university systems. people tend to value, you know, a Harvard, a Yale, a Princeton graduate or a degree more than some of the other institutions in our country. And it's one of the things that is saddling all this new generation with this enormous debt. So I think Americans put too great a value on name and, you know, upper echelon colleges, and I think we need to really evaluate what kind of education they're getting at some of the 2-year and 4-year colleges that are right in their backyard that are, you know, more affordable.
And Judy's right. I mean, you can get a great education at a wide range of schools, and one of the strengths of American higher education is that kind of institutional diversity. And I agree with you, a name can be overrated. You just got to look at the individuals.
All right, we have letters here, and I want to go to those. Bob says, after the panel finished, oh, I did that one. I'm sorry. Apologies. The Atlantic Magazine reports today that the government's disease-fighting agency is conflating viral and antibody tests, comprising a few crucial metrics that governors depend on to reopen their economies. Is anything coming out of our government believable anymore? We'll leave that hanging in the air unless anyone wants to go after it.
No, well, when you have a lying liar, as the president of the United States, who tells one whopper after another, it does diminish what people will believe is true. Now, it may not be his acolytes, but it certainly is true of the rest of the country, and you see that in the polling. They don't trust the guy. And if you don't trust your president, who do you trust? On the other hand, you should see all the people who are buying that medicine now because the president said buy it.
Paul.
Alan, let me
just jump in
with a quick comment. I do think that hope springs eternal. I hope that one of the winners out of this whole episode that we're living through, the coronavirus, is science. I think that just the sheer volume of information that we are being forced to deal with about all the different dimensions of this just demonstrates the importance of real science, real data. And we have those concepts, the value of science and the value of empirical data, have been under attack systematically in this country for too many years. And so I'm just hoping that one of the things that emerges is some people taking another look and realizing that there is a difference between scientific research and conspiracy theories on the internet. They won't convince everybody.
But, by the way, so, Phil, all a very good point. On the other hand, there's a story on the wires today about how Fauci all of a sudden is absent. No talking from Fauci as the president presses to open up the economy one more time. So one gets the idea that depending on who wins the election, science will either suffer or win out.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I think that there's a clear track record here of what's happened to federal agencies in this administration, the dismantling of staffs, suppression of scientific information. I mean, the track record is there and it's in the public domain. So that's absolutely true. Elections have consequences. But my point, I think, can stand against that as well. It's just that I would hope that people would take a look at the need for science, for real science, and the need for the dissemination of this kind of information clearly and see how that is connected to electoral choices.
Well, you may be right. On the other hand,
I don't know.
On the other hand, take a look at Kentucky right now. Very interesting race. Mitch McConnell is head on. I think it's 41-41. You know, in that state, whether the science and, you know, the respect for science is part of that in Kentucky, I don't know. But there's still a hell of a lot of people who are on the other side.
That's true.
Yeah, but
that's
true. Alan, don't you think it's interesting that he's McConnell's even in this position? It shows that even Kentucky has people that are beginning to doubt the kind of, you know, going back to the old ways. I think this is a sign that more and more people are beginning to think about the long-term consequences for this economy and this society and its human resources. If we don't pay attention to what some of the fundamental problems are with manipulating data and not following the science.
We're going to put a pause there. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Philip Glotzbach, and Vera Akarius-Kelly, we welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We have a lot of them. I promise we'll get to them on the other side of the break. Panel at WAMC.org. First News with Ray Graff.
Peace will, peace will come. Let it begin with me. We need peace. Let it begin with me. Oh, my own life is all I can hope to control. Live for the good, good of my soul. Let it bring peace, sweet peace. Peace will come. Let it begin with me.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judy Patrick, Philip Glotzbach, and Vera Akarius-Kelly. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We do have a number of them, so let me get to them now. Eric says the president's attempts to suppress voting and control the press is consistent with his admiration of and desire to emulate Vladimir Putin. That is what Trump respects as strength. It's entirely consistent with his refusal to tolerate oversight and respond to subpoenas from the House of Representatives. He'd prefer to have our political system work much like Russia's.
Well, that's right. That's right. The problem, of course, is that you can have strength. I think JFK had strength. There's a difference between strength and, well, in my estimation, evil strength.
Hmm. Joseph writes about voter fraud and says, awfully rich of Trump to associate Democrats with voter fraud and voting by mail when a Republican operative in North Carolina was caught doing just that in a recent election. Fair point. Susan writes and says, so it's great he wants to recognize the Ford plan that is belatedly Donald for making ventilators, but we know it's just a form of a rally to his base, and there's been a terrible flood in Michigan, and he's not going to go over to that town and show sympathy and support? Question mark, question mark, question mark?
And could I read
that? Yeah, I guess that's a really good point. Oh, yeah, Alan, no. I just was going to say this is typical for Trump. It's a rally. He might not wear a mask to protect those workers in the Ford plant, and he certainly doesn't seem to show any empathy.
Yep. Can I read one, Joe? And that's from our great friend Sarah Craig, who is the head of the executive director of Cafe Lena, the great Cafe Lena in Saratoga. Said that today is Cafe Lena's 60th anniversary, and Tom Paxton is one of the 15 musicians who will be playing a song and telling a story during tonight's online celebration, which starts at 7 p.m. It's cafelena.org. Again, thank you, Sarah. You're terrific.
Excellent. Yes. Thank you, Sarah. All right. Let's see. We go to Paul, who says, what do you think the odds are that if states use mail-in ballots this fall and Trump loses the election, that he will accept the results?
Well, you know, when we first started talking about this, I dismissed that as being utter nonsense. You know, we got a lot of letters. Now I'm not so sure. I think this guy is capable of stopping at nothing. Nothing could stop him. I mean, I think there's so much at stake for him, both personally, legally, and every other way, that we have seen him just take on these incredible positions. And I think the letter writer makes a good point.
You know, we had an interview with a professor at Amherst by the name of Lawrence Douglas, who wrote a book called Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. I think it was on Tuesday. It's online at WAMC.org. But he is a legal scholar, and he's talking about what really the guardrails that we think are in place really aren't that strong. And talks about what has to be done. That if it is, if Trump loses and it's close, or even if he perceives it to be close, that there is a lot there that he could bring on, and a system that may not necessarily work. Vera.
Yeah, I mean, to me, what is most frightening in that sense is that we all believe the foundation of the way we operate in a society is based on trust and a system where we just simply say, well, these are the rules that we follow. Now, Trump is the chaos president. He likes to break rules and then accuse the other side of having not followed the rules accurately, while he's simply smashing through regulations and cultural and social expectations that have existed for a long time. So it's a very scary time. And one wonders, not only will he question the legitimacy of mail-in voting, but he might also call on some of his most rabid supporters to defend him in person. And that is something that I worry about in certain states where, you know, just the call for freedom and certain key words have mobilized small but perhaps aggressive subgroups from society.
Judy Patrick.
So, you know, what's fascinating to me is that he's only 11 points behind while there are 93,000 Americans who have died from this virus and there are 38 million people unemployed, and he's only 11 points behind. Now, that seems like maybe some people think that's a lot, but there are a vast number of people that are still supporting where you have people dying, dropping dead. And this vast economic collapse. Nonetheless, he's within reach, and there's a lot of time between now and election day.
Absolutely true. The problem for him is that he was 6 points behind. Now he's 11 points behind, and I think big momentum is going against him. I've continued to say it. I'll say it again. I think this is going to be a wipeout for him. And if it is a wipeout, there's going to be no choice on his part except to do some of the nefarious things people are suggesting.
Meanwhile, we have 5 months of this. Yes, Philip.
I want to come back to Vera's point about institutions. And I do think that what we have seen over the last few years has been a wake-up call for every citizen who pays attention. I certainly was one who had faith in institutions, and I still do. But the point that it brings home is that institutions require people, to make decisions, to implement laws, to do this, and that there's a lot of latitude that people have in making judgments about how those institutions work. And so once again, elections do have consequences, and we've seen that. And at an even broader level, you come back to the point that I think Judy made before, that she said, you know, President Trump believes what he wants to. In a larger point, we all believe what we want to. We are responsible for our beliefs. We make those decisions. We don't necessarily make them consciously in every given moment. It is possible to doubt anything. You can't doubt all your beliefs at once, but you can. And so then the question becomes, so how do people decide what they believe? And, I was talking about science and data before and argument. Nobody's a perfect rational agent, but this whole question of public trust and the assault on reason and the assault on truth and all that brings home the realization that as citizens we do have responsibilities to own our beliefs and then to be serious about how it is that we form our beliefs.
We have a couple of letters regarding college admissions and the case that we were talking about earlier this morning. I agree completely, says Laura, about small schools. I attended a public K-12 school, Coble Skill College, and then SUNY Albany. I thought both schools were wonderful. Classmates who attended elite schools and they or their parents paid tons of money are not doing any better than I. I never understood paying all that money. I also had a student who was accepted to Harvard. His family did not have money. He decided to attend a local community college for 2 years and to save money and then transfer to Cornell. He recently gave a TED Talk. I'm so proud of him. Go public education, says Laura. We then got one from Chris, who says, question, has Donald Trump ever graduated from any school or college? His military academy records are buried, deliberately hidden on pain of lawsuit against New York Military Academy. What records are there that he even attended at Fordham? His acceptance at Wharton came via a friend of the family. Dad Trump gave big bucks to Fordham and Wharton. And then Kim says, I just wanted to weigh in on an actual rower. As an actual rower, I meandered my way through high school in a very unremarkable way, but was lucky enough to be at a private school on the Charles River and become captain of the rowing team, which got me into my safety school. I transferred with a letter of recommendation from the Undersecretary General of the United Nations and paid for tuition with a found Beethoven manuscript that was auctioned at Sotheby's. The process for getting into college and paying for it is insanely unfair. Reform, it's time. The United States has never been further from a meritocracy than it is today. There's a lot to unpack in that note, but I'd love to hear Kim's story fully about the Beethoven manuscript.
Sounds like a great story and a very successful person, very determined and focused, and obviously rowing, when you're a competitive rower, it's incredibly hard sport.
And how do you find a Beethoven manuscript? It's all very cool. I don't know.
Maybe in your attic.
Yeah, I don't. It's interesting. All right.
Can I just say there are so many pathways to success in life, and of course a lot of different ways to define that. But there's just so many ways to do it, and the sheer ingenuity of people, and the stick-to-itiveness, persistence, the resilience that people show at colleges and universities across the country. It's inspirational. So there's no one way to do it.
All right, Philip, this one's for you, and it's from Howard. It just came in. It's not bad. It's just the big billion-dollar question. So what will colleges do in September?
When you figure that out, send me an email.
They're wondering what the plan is. Yes.
It is a huge question, and what we are seeing is a whole range of plans creatively thought through from colleges and universities across the country. NYU just announced just within the hour, apparently, that it's going to reopen for in-person classes in the fall. There are two principles here that I think every school is trying to follow. The first one is that you have to pay attention to the health and safety of the students, the faculty and staff, and the surrounding community. And there has to be a set of answers to, questions about protocol. What are you going to do? Atul Gawande, the physician who writes for The New Yorkers and marvelous books, was on CNN the other day, and he was talking about experiences that they've had at his hospital in Boston, and said, we've learned how to do this. And there are four pillars for safe operations. You have to have hygiene, distancing, masking, and then screening, which includes testing and quarantining and, all that. And so any school that's thinking about reopening has to have a set of answers to the question of how you implement those, how you implement those four ideas, those four principles. And the second thing is that schools want to provide the best possible education for their students within the context of their mission. And so how do you do that? So many of us had the experience this spring when we moved to remote learning of it's reinforcing the power of in-person, in-class education. You can do a lot online. Some terrific things can happen. But for a school like Skidmore, Siena, learning in a residential community is very special. So how do you do that? Mm-hmm. I think that there are principles. It's becoming pretty clear that nobody thinks it's going to be business as usual. So everybody has to have some form of social distancing and so on. And many schools are saying, well, we can't have our whole population on campus. And they're trying to figure out how that's going to work. There are schools, Notre Dame, my alma mater, just announced it's going to start early and send everybody home by Thanksgiving. We're looking at a plan like that, because the thought is that once students disperse for Thanksgiving, you don't want them coming back to campus, and you don't need to. So people are looking at all those different models. It depends on guidance from the states. We cannot say what we are going to do definitively in the fall until we have clearance from the governor's office to execute a plan. We are certainly looking at that. We would all love to be open in some form, and I think most schools realize that there are going to be restraints on that. So
Philip, I'm assuming that the words lawsuits never came up in any college president's discussions, because obviously they have to have.
Well, there are class action lawsuits out there that some law firms, frankly, are pushing to go after schools for not providing tuition rebates when they went to remote learning in the spring. Mm-hmm. So it's the legal environment, and one has to worry about legal liability, and businesses are worried about that, and that's why some kind of safe harbor provision. Is under discussion at the federal and state levels to talk about businesses, which would include colleges and universities, I would think, to protect them from lawsuits for damages if they reopen and someone gets sick.
So I wanted to mention at this point one thought that is of particular interest. I think places like schools like Siena and like Skidmore know exactly what to do in terms of how to route students through campus, set up classrooms and, you know, split up students, put them in larger spaces. All of these kinds of configurations we can think through and hypothesize as long as the governor permits in-person teaching. The question is, what happens after hours? The students, in essence, on campus could be the wild card. Do we have students that follow social distancing rules, or will they engage in behavior that challenges our expectations and our rules? And so that is something that we have not quite yet figured out how to deal with. I was just speaking with some of my students who are RAs. And they're mentioning some of those concerns. Obviously, students have to live in single rooms, and or alternatively, there is a model of pod living. So a small group of students would live together in a pod for the semester and do everything together. So these are the difficult issues yet to be resolved. And I think all institutions are struggling with daily changes and new reports on where we're at, what other institutions are doing, and how to deal with this potential wild card of student behavior.
I certainly agree with Vera on this. This is a big question that has to be answered. You know, if you look at colleges and universities, I would bet that almost all of them, if you look at their mission statement, have something in there about citizenship. We talk about preparing informed, responsible citizens. This is a moment when we really can step up to that part of the mission. And we really do have to challenge our students to live up to that value. And to say that being a responsible citizen in this day and age requires one to do this and that. And it is a challenge for students of traditional college age, certainly. I mean, they're not known for always making good decisions. There's no sugarcoating that. Although I'm sure that no one on this panel ever misbehaved as an undergraduate.
No.
Right. No one ever broke a rule or anything. But honestly, I think that there's a huge educational opportunity for colleges and universities who do try to reopen in the fall in one form or another to really talk seriously with their students and say, look, this is a moment when we're talking about civic responsibility, how we act together. And it's a larger question. I said that I think that science and maybe the concept of the truth could be a winner out of this. The other one, I think, is civic virtue. the idea that we need to work together, and all the different things that you see on the evening news about people applauding first responders and healthcare workers and so on, and people stepping up to help their neighbors in this. The stereotype during the stereotype about how people behave during a crisis is that, you know, that there are riots and people immediately go berserk. If you see the film Contagion that was made in 2011, which is pretty prescient about what we're facing now, right, you know, has scenes of people doing that. In fact, empirically, people do not respond to earthquakes and floods and, you know, these disasters that way. They respond differently. So what we have to do is help our students understand that this is a moment when we need to step up and have concern for other people who are our co-community members, co-citizens, and that our behavior has to reflect that. It's a challenge, but I think it's an opportunity for education.
All right, we have a couple more letters here in our last. We have 5 minutes or so before a break at the bottom of the hour. We go to James. He says, there's a simple solution to eliminate all of the issues around voter fraud, attacks on election credibility, and that is national ID cards. Want to vote, drive, obtain social services, social security, biometric ID cards would streamline many of the processes. The papers, please argument no longer holds weight. We have very little privacy in today's technology-based world and broadcast information about our lives 24/7 via our cell phones. Take the argument away from the right by solving the problem. Anyone on that?
Well, in essence, it's a possibility. However, during the current coronavirus situation, there is no way every U.S. citizen or resident will go to an office to have biometric data taken. I mean, this requires a personal visit to an office for specialized photography. I mean, think of the millions of people that have to line up and the kind of systems the U.S. government would have to have. Of course, it's worth investing in for the future, but currently impossible.
We go to Paul, who says the nation that have successfully managed the coronavirus are all led by females. New Zealand stands out. So perhaps we should eliminate male voting. All right.
Hooray.
Judy, this one's from you. What do you think about the latest press secretary, McEnany? She said she'd never lie. That big briefing book she uses has the administration's answers to everything.
Yeah, she's already lied at least once. At least she's holding press briefings. There's that. I've never been a big fan of press briefings. I know that people think that's important for them to stand up and be accountable to the press once a day. But over the years, they're just mostly dog and pony shows where they're just preaching the same information that the administration wants to dispel. But I was hoping that the White House press corps would be could really ask some probing questions, but they just they're spinning round and round. So kudos to her for standing up there, but she's lying. She's not a reliable presenter of information. It's not her fault. She's doing what she is being told. Her constituency is the president. She's not working for the American people or the American people's right to know. She's working to impress her boss. And so far, she's doing a good job of that.
Ed says that rather than assisting Trump and his brown shirt thugs are piling on Michigan, one of our fellow states, and seeking to paralyze Governor Gretchen Whitmer in the midst of a flood and a pandemic crisis. Then we go to Jeffrey, who says on college admissions, any college involved in an admissions scandal must prove innocence while federal student aid is withheld. Allison says on colleges, we have sheltered in place a mere 2+ months. They want kids to be on campus in the fall. Why not remote? My daughter could bring it home and end up an orphan. There is no lawsuit that can fix that. I hope colleges come to their senses. They want their tuition. I get it.
But also remember that colleges are...
Go ahead, Judy.
They're
Go
really
ahead,
important Judy. Economic they're economic engines also for the communities in which they sit, in Saratoga Springs, for Skidmore, Loudonville down in Siena, every place that has a college, the thousands of people that work in the cafeteria, that maintain the grounds, that teach the classes. I know that's not that's a secondary issue, but it's one we can't forget.
And also I wanted to mention, we here at Siena, we're looking at a variety of options. Students that can choose online options, hybrid, begin to meet on campus for a period of time, and then if things get difficult, go online or shortened on in-person courses. So there are a variety of options on the table that are under discussion, and all of those options are worthwhile considering depending on what the individual student's home location is, family setup, space, access to technology. I mean, there's so many questions to figure out. That is why we're constantly on college campuses meeting and discussing as soon as we get information to come up with alternative ways or multiple ways in which we can serve our student community.
I have to pause you there. We have to take a break. We'll be right back after this.
Outward bound, upon a ship that sails no ocean. Outward bound, it has no crew but me and you all alone. When just a minute ago the shore was filled with people that we knew. Outward bound, on a journey without ending, outward bound. Uncharted waters beneath our bow, far behind. The green familiar shore is fading into time, and time has left us now. So farewell, adieu, so long, via con Dio. May they find whatever they are looking for. Remember when the wine was better than ever again. We could not ask, we could not ask for more. Outward bound.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We do welcome your letters. Panel, last call, by the way, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Just have about 10 minutes or so, so we will get to as many as we possibly can. panel@wamc.org. Let us talk real quick about the story on the Supreme Court stopping House Democrats from seeing secret Mueller material. For now, at least, the Supreme Court on Wednesday stopped House Democrats from seeing secret grand jury material from Robert Mueller's investigation of Russian interference into the 2016 election and whether President Trump obstructed the special counsel's work. The court, without noted dissent, agreed to a request from the Justice Department to put on hold a lower court's decision granting the House Judiciary Committee some previously undisclosed material from Mueller's probe. The action could mean that Congress will not receive the full Mueller report without redactions of certain grand jury material until after the November election, or perhaps not even during lawmakers' current term, which ends January 3rd. Alan, what do you think?
Well, I only have, I don't have a lot of time to say everything I want, so I'll put it down to one word: infuriating.
Yeah. So what do you do about it? I mean, it doesn't
there
seem.
There's nothing you can do. You can't elect the Supreme Court. They have been disgusting in their adherence to Trump. He put his people on, and they are saluting and marching in step, the majority. What we don't know here is whether there was any objection to this at all. Maybe there was a deal in the conference, which was, okay, we'll let everybody see it, but not until after the election. That's only fair. And how? And who in this world thinks that Trump plays fair ever? I mean, it's just, it is, as I say, infuriating.
Judy Patrick.
You know, Trump has successfully used the court system in all sorts of cases to delay, to postpone inquiries into his activities. He's used the court system. A lot of people do this. It's one of the reasons why people try to avoid going to court, because it is a time-consuming and it protracts things like this forever. And Trump is an expert at playing this game. And once again, he's succeeded.
And also, I think it's one of the major concerns of the Roberts Court has been to protect and guard the Supreme Court's credibility as a non-political institution. And so they've really struggled with figuring out how not to be attacked or called, activist judges or pursuing ideas that are not constitutional. I mean, they are just simply fearful of a frontal assault and questioning of credibility by the Trump administration and Trump himself.
Philip, anything on that?
I don't have anything to add on that. I don't know enough of the details about this decision. I do worry about, one of the commentators on the Commonwealth Club broadcast on AMC, I think it was yesterday, said that the Trump administration has actually been quite adept at using the courts and circumventing rules and to push its agenda. And it's interesting that sort of ability hasn't come to the fore in managing this crisis that we're in. So where they seem to be pretty good at getting their way and doing things that are high on their agenda, we have seen less success here. So I just repeat a point that was made, and I agree with it. I think it's surprising.
Remember when all we used to talk about was the Mueller report?
The good old days.
The good old days. That was all we
Mueller
talked
report
about.
Was going to solve everything.
That's right. We would be.
And how did that work out?
The House went to court in July before the formal start of its impeachment proceedings. In July, before the start of its impeachment proceedings involving the president's alleged effort to pressure Ukraine to investigate former Vice President Joe Biden, now the presumptive Democratic nominee to challenge Trump in November, a divided D.C. Circuit Court found that the House was legally engaged in a judicial process that exempts Congress from secrecy rules that typically shield grand jury materials from disclosure. And, Alan, this goes back to your infuriating remark, but it is, if the Congress can't get a hold of a report, then who can?
Yeah, that's right. There are three branches of government. There's a reason that the Congress is number one. This president has decided he doesn't have to listen to anything that the Congress does, reminiscent of people like Mussolini and others who created dictatorships on that exact kind of approach. John Roberts, the Chief Justice, said there are no Republican and Democratic judges. Let me repeat that. He said there are no such things as Republican and Democratic judges, just judges. Are you kidding?
Well, that's what he wants all of us to believe, right?
In just our final moments, go ahead. Were you going to say something, Philip?
Just quickly, I mean, it goes back to the point I made before, and that is you have institutions, but they require people. And even though Congress clearly has responsibilities for oversight, if the executive does not cooperate, if the judicial does not back them up, then that or just if you have a majority in one of the houses that wants to block a particular type of oversight proceedings, then it's not going to happen, regardless of what's written in the Constitution or in statutes.
So it all comes back down to the elections. It all comes back down to November. If the right people in the right places in this country have decided that's enough, you can't make fool of yourself, Mr. President, anymore. We're kicking you out. We're firing you. You're fired. It'll make all the difference in the world. If not, there are going to be a lot of people looking for other places to live.
In addition to that, I would say we need to really reflect on the power of the executive and not continue on this pattern where whoever's in the White House keeps expanding the parameters and walls. And of course, we have seen this in particular now, but we have seen this pattern before. When the executive becomes so influential that the other branches become less powerful. And that is a very challenging dilemma we're facing.
You know, I got a prediction to make, and that is if the Democrats take the Senate and the Democrats take the presidency, there'll be a slew of legislation against presidents and others doing the kinds of things that this president has done.
And yes.
Because they'll want to, quote, the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the War Powers Act is an example of something that came about some years back with in this kind of a moment.
That's right.
So,
well, we are out of time. I want to thank everybody for being with us, and thank you so much for your contributions. Philip Glotzbach, we'll have you back probably while you're still a college president, but we thank you very much for being with us, as always.
Thank you, Joe.
Vera, thank you so much for being with us this morning. Judy, thank you. Always great to have you. And Alan, be well. We'll talk tomorrow.
We will indeed.
Excellent.
All right. Take care.
We'll be right back after this.